we get things underway by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
How's it going, Rich?
Wonderful. How are you, sir?
Okay. Same. Well, no, that's a lie. I'm horrible. But I'm here. I've made it thus far through the day to be here with you in the bosom of your great show.
Well, we appreciate you making it that much better by your presence, your knowledge, your awesomeness. And today, we focus on a particularly fertile period of live rock and roll from 1970.
Yes, the live album, which was not much of a thing prior to 1968, in rock and roll anyway. It was always there in jazz. You can go get excellent live jazz recordings back to the 1930s, which is quite fascinating because you wouldn't think you could have field recordings of that vintage. But with rock and roll, because you do not have people politely sitting in a jazz club or air shots over the radio, say for something with the BBC, you had a lot of screaming teeny boppers, and technology wasn't such that it could overcome the wave of teeny bopper sound coming at the stage until about 1968. And then come 1970, 50 years ago, the live album becomes a big, big deal. In one way, could be, potentially. In another way, it becomes a holding pattern because people used to put out a lot of product. In a different age, when people had, I think, more ability in the musical arena, and they worked harder. So it wasn't every 7 or 8 years you'd drop an album on the public. You'd have an album 1 year, and then maybe later that year, to buy yourself some more time while you worked in the studio, you would put out a live album.
Well, let's start with the Rolling Stones, who released, well, I was surprised to read this, the first live album to go to number one in the UK, Get Your Ya-Ya's Out.
Yes, and the recordings come from the year before, 1969, Baltimore and New York, and they were put together on this live set. Now, they had released previously a live album, which does document the teeny bopper screaming. And I think it's really yeoman's effort on their part that they play as well as they do on that given date from a few years earlier. But this is one where, and if you've seen footage of them performing at Madison Square Garden on that tour, the audience is rapt. They're sitting on their hands, quite literally often. And they're listening the way you would listen to, oh, I don't know, if Miles Davis's second great quintet had come to town and you really wanted to pay attention to what Tony Williams and Wayne Shorter were doing. And it's not the full concert. It's not even a facsimile of the full concert. It's kind of pick and choose, cherry pick, that kind of deal. And it is some of the best lead guitar blues rock playing you will hear, courtesy of Mick Taylor, who was with the band during this time. And if you listen closely, this is a very weird thing, and I wonder if anyone else has noticed this. If you have headphones on and you listen carefully, you will eventually at one point hear a woman say from the crowd, "Paint it black, you devil." Now, I don't know if this was like a Rolling Stones in-joke, but you will hear that on subsequent live albums going forward when you listen with headphones. You will hear that same snippet. So I don't know if they just patched it into everything, but it certainly fit the mood of that particular disc.
Also, a couple of tributes to one of their heroes on this. Well, a couple of their heroes. A great version of Robert Johnson's Love in Vain, and also a couple of Chuck Berry tunes.
Love in Vain has the quintessential slow blues Mick Taylor. So Mick Taylor was the most skilled, technically, musician the Rolling Stones ever had. He was someone who you can hear in Sympathy for the Devil, for instance, that he takes his solo and Keith Richards has his solo. You can contrast the two. It's, in a sense, it's like Harrison and Lennon in the Beatles, except both of these players in the Stones were better players than either of those two. But Love in Vain has this beautiful, yearning blues guitar solo. And then the Chuck Berry numbers were right up the Rolling Stones street, because Chuck Berry, I've seen recent conversation where Elvis would have turned 85, and people were saying that you have to remember that the real pioneer of rock and roll was Chuck Berry. Well, first of all, it's not strictly true, because it's not like chronologically Chuck Berry beat Elvis to anything, but Chuck Berry was a rhythm and blues artist more than a rock and roll artist for certainly his first few years, and the Rolling Stones wanted to be a rhythm and blues band more than anything, so it makes sense that they would cover those two numbers.
Colin, is there a backstory on the donkey?
It was just, I guess you would call whimsy. The larger backstory in terms of the cover is the fact that Charlie Watts, who is kind of the straight man of the Rolling Stones, right? He was the Zeppo, if he was in the Marx Brothers. That was so out of character for him to don all this insignia and everything and sort of cavort about, and they thought that was just Rolling Stones. I'm sure there were other Rolling Stones hijinks that they couldn't depict on a cover, but that was meant to be all whimsical.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown about some great live rock recordings from 1970, and let's move to Jimi Hendrix's Band of Gypsies, recorded at Fillmore East, and historic because it was the first time without the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Yes, this is Hendrix on literally the eve of what will be his last year of life. And what I admire about this album, and it came out as Band of Gypsies, and recently the entire shebang, all of the sets from that night have been released in a box set, is that Hendrix was not afraid of failure. He was not afraid of creating what I consider, as an album, a noble failure, because this band was not as good as the Jimi Hendrix Experience. He put them together and rehearsed them for these shows, thinking, okay, this is kind of stale, what I'm doing with these other guys. I want to do something different. And when it devolves into this quasi-funk, it doesn't really work. But then there are these other moments, if you're willing to wait those other ones out, where Hendrix goes to this apogee level that I don't know if he hits anywhere else. Maybe at the Royal Albert Hall show from 1969, somewhere like that. But on Machine Gun, for instance, there's a lot of ballyhoo about Star Spangled Banner and Woodstock and everything. Machine Gun is so much more akin to the sound of a sort of populist societal national anthem, I think. It's this strafing, insane metal blues sonic warfare track. And he comes off the stage, he does this version of it, and Bill Graham, the promoter, says, look, that was really good. He's waiting in the wings. Hendrix is going to go back on again later. And he says, I think you can do better, though. Hendrix is like, what the hell, man? That was pretty good. So with that in mind, Hendrix, being so competitive, does go back out and rallies to an even higher level with a subsequent version of Machine Gun.
And is it safe to say that even if it wasn't a big success, it signaled that he was not going to be contained in any one genre, that he was experimenting, as you mentioned, with funk, more of a soulful sound, and certainly different than what he had done with the Experience?
Yes, I think that's true. I think Hendrix had a lot of Stravinsky in him, and he had a lot of Miles Davis in him, and he had a lot of Dylan in him, actually. And those three artists, they'd hop around from style to style. They would birth new styles that might have been an amalgamation of a couple other styles and then something else with their own particular spin. He was that way. I mean, there was talk of him playing with Miles Davis at some point. He didn't live long enough, of course. But if you look at Miles Davis's direction from 1968 on, and in 1970, A Bitch's Brew for Miles Davis later in the spring, that's the type of music that would have been in Hendrix's particular era. And so, yes, I think he would have done so many things. He would have done some crazy concept meta disco album at some point. I don't think there was any kind of idiom that he would not have ventured into.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown about live rock and roll from 1970. And let's move to one of the many Led Zeppelin bootlegs, Mudslide, recorded in Vancouver.
Now, I have to say something about this because some people out there in Rich Kimball land have been aggrieved in the past that I have said that Led Zeppelin is quite terrible. I do think they're quite terrible. I think they're kind of inept. But I mentioned earlier that there was at least a number of bootlegs by Zeppelin that I found really entertaining, palatable, and this would be one of them. It's from March 1970 in Vancouver, and Trademark of Quality was the bootleg label that put it out, and it was the kind of thing, record that would be sold out of the back of some hippie's car, and it was rubber stamped on the cover. It was actually rubber stamped on the cover, and we'll talk about the Who's Live at Leeds, which is kind of a take on a riff on that cover idea. And one reason it's so good is, first of all, it's early in Zeppelin's career. They're touring behind Led Zeppelin II. And you're getting this truncated album. Because of the bootleg medium, you could only have 20 minutes of music on each side of the record. Otherwise, if you have more than 20 minutes of music on a vinyl record, at least back then, this is why John Lennon didn't want Beatles sides to have more, you lose volume. And who wants Zeppelin without max volume, right? So you're getting this abbreviated performance, so you don't have all of the waste. You don't have the 19-minute solos. You have a great rendition of Thank You, which is Zeppelin doing Tenderness. I guess it's their version of Kiss's Best. And it's quite moving. The sound is crackly, but that just makes it more atmospheric. And it's a great little document of when these guys were really trying to make it. They were pushing the envelope. It's exciting. They weren't resting on their laurels yet.
All right. Now, finally, let's talk about The Who's Live at Leeds, the only live album with the original members of the band, and a crossroads for them after the success of Tommy, that they didn't want to be labeled, or many of them didn't want to be labeled as an art rock band. They wanted to show that they could just get back to their roots.
They wanted to, yes. And they also wanted to have that holding pattern that we talked about, because Tommy, The Who have released so few studio albums when you think about it. There's like a dozen of them. There just really aren't that many over a lot of years. And so the big thinking after the come down of Tommy was that they would record all of these shows in the U.S. And then they would go through the tapes. They put this live album together. They get back to England. Pete Townshend looks at this stack of recordings and says, "Oh, no, I can't do this. Let's just record a couple shows here." So one of them was in Hull, and another one was in Leeds on Valentine's Day, 1970, with Hull on the 15th. And it's interesting because you have to know, I feel like, how to listen to this album. It has been released over the years in its full version, not in the right order, with Tommy set aside from everything else, which is not exactly, it's not how the concert actually went. And the original version, though, was just six songs, and it was 37 minutes long. And there's this ideological dilemma with live albums. Do you want the full show? Do you want an approximation of a show? Or do you want to go the cherry pick route? And here, the album is the six songs, works perfectly. Four of them are from the early portion of the concert. Two of them are the last two songs. One of them, My Generation, is 14 minutes and 27 seconds long. And you could build an entire career out of the musical motifs of this. Now, they would actually reprise those motifs each night, so it's not strictly extemporized, but, man, you hear it. There are these riffs that another band would give their souls to be able to do. And it is, to me, one of the very first true out-and-out heavy metal albums.
Yeah, I love their version of Summertime Blues that, to me, is the only one that approaches Eddie Cochran.
Oh, it's so heavy. And The Who were funny, like John Entwistle was funny, Boris the Spider. So he does the funny voice that could seem a bit much in other cover versions, although I like Blue Cheer's version is actually maybe even funnier, because rather than doing the voice, they just have the bass go type of thing, and then the drums like, and that's it. It's like, okay, there you go. Thanks, Blue Cheer. But yeah, it's very heavy, and it just, they had this kick to them, this swagger, this punkishness. And Eddie Cochran was very punk, right? You don't think of him that way now. But Eddie Cochran, he had some Johnny Rotten in him. So they channel that well, I think.
So of these four albums we discussed, which one does the best job of giving us an auditory glimpse of what these bands were like in concert?
I would say Live at Leeds. Live at Leeds, you could shortlist as one of the, 12 or 15 best rock records of all time. And I don't think there are many live albums you can say that about. Live albums to me when I was a kid were, and I guess they still are, they were more exciting because it was like the difference between maybe watching a game on TV and being down and seeing the sweat come off the players, the puck goes flying over the boards type of deal. But in terms of a virtuosic statement, this is one of our best ever works of art. Live at Leeds is a better album than Who's Next. Up there, it's probably better than Quadrophenia. It might be better than Tommy. I mean, it's that good. It is the Who experience distilled, whereas with the other bands, I think you can easily go to other records where we say, okay, are you experienced? Sympathy for the Devil, Let It Bleed, Exile on Main Street, that type of thing. The Who, this might have been the apex.
Colin Fleming talking music with us here on a Tuesday afternoon. Hey, Colin, before we let you go, we haven't talked about this in advance, but you'll have an answer. I know you will. We'll find out in about an hour or so who's going in the Baseball Hall of Fame this year. Who should go?
Who should go? Jeter will obviously, of course, go in, and Jeter is wildly underrated. I can't believe I'm saying that as a Red Sox fan, but he's an incredibly underrated player as an overall offensive performer. Schilling should go in, Bond should go in, Clemens should go in, your man Larry Walker should go in, and I really can't think of anyone else right now who, I guess Jeff Kent's maybe the closest, but no, I think those people, and it's starting to look from what I last saw like Jeter will be the only one who goes, your man Shaughnessy, not your man,
yes.
I say that facetiously, made this point of just voting for Jeter. It's like, grow up. I mean, Larry Walker, right? He's
right.
Obviously a Hall of Famer. The others you can pick your quibbles with or whatever, and Schilling should be going in regardless of how you feel about what he says. He doesn't molest kids. He doesn't rape anybody. He says dumb things. You should go in. But to only vote for Jeter and to maybe cost Larry Walker his chance, that's just wrong.
Well, that's Shank in a nutshell right there. Colin, we thank you as always. Appreciate it. And we'll check in again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming. Visit his website, colinflemminglit.com.